The Guardian.
We know you all love football, but if you fancy taking a break from the beautiful game, here's an offer you won't want to miss. Right now on Guardian.co.uk, you can watch the award-winning film Skeletons, starring Jason Isaacs, and you can save 10% just for being a listener of Football Weekly. Skeletons is the story of a pair of travelling psychic detectives helping people remove the metaphysical skeletons from their closets. It's eccentric, heartfelt, and very, very funny. The film costs just £3.49 to stream or £5.49 to download. And you can save a further 10% by entering the promotion code SAVEME. To check out the trailer and to find out more, head to guardian.co.uk/skeletons.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Football Weekly, looking back on another big weekend. Loftus Road, nation obsesses over what footballer does pre-game with hand in biggest hand-shaking drama since Tony Adams went on the wagon. Elsewhere, while Anton wasn't feeling shaky, Man City were 1-1 at Stoke ahead of trip to Madrid. Arsenal, no Van Persie and no mercy as Gunners smash Saints, and Spurs leave Royals exposed like French paps. We ran up all the weekend action, apart from Norwich West Ham, and look ahead to the midweek games. There's Madrid in crisis with Mu in a mood, Juve at Chelsea and Italian news, and so much more in today's Football Weekly. Hello, everybody, and hey, Rosh Hashanah.
Hashanah?
What?
Hashanah.
That to all our Jewish listeners.
And everyone else.
And everyone else as well. It's the year 5773, and Jacob...
We're still doing the pod.
Hey! Great news. It is Jacob Steinberg. Hi.
Hi.
Alongside him, James Horncastle.
Hello.
Hello. And in an especially veteran lineup today, Michael Cox also in.
Hello, James.
All right, then. We are young, just like in that song, eh? It's the fresh sound of a new generation of football punditry breaking through. I tell you what, let's start with the Gunners and that Southampton game. Now, let's see, Arsenal... I had down in crisis. No, they're contenders now, James. Isn't that right?
Yeah, they were excellent. Everything kind of went right for them on the day. I'm not going to take anything away from Arsenal. Southampton were in disarray from the very beginning. They scored an own goal, two own goals, in fact, by Højbjerg and Klein. And it's kind of difficult to get a read on this Arsenal team at the moment, I think, because their first two games they played, Sunderland and Stoke. So two teams that tend to defend very deep, and it's flattering for their defence but unflattering for their attack. Played Liverpool, who are in sort of all kinds of trouble. Then Saturday against Southampton, Southampton didn't really give the kind of performance that we've come to expect for them so far this season.
But that might be Arsenal's merit, Southampton had looked plucky and spirited against Man City, Man United, but against Arsenal they looked, a shambles,
Yeah, they didn't offer anything in the first half, and it was quite worrying. And they came back into it after the interval, but there was a lack of Arsenal had already got the job done, really.
All right. James doesn't know what to make of Arsenal. What can you help him with there, Michael?
Well, I agree. I don't think any side will go to the Emirates and play as open as Southampton did, and they just played into Arsenal's hands. I mean, Arsenal went with a very quick attacking three of Jovinho, Podolski, Oxlade-Chamberlain. A similar approach against Sunderland didn't really work, but against Southampton, who was so high up the pitch and leaving such gaps, I mean, the goal that Jovinho scored when he thumped it in at the near post, I mean, his movement was so basic, and yet he found himself in about 20 yards of space. It was incredible.
That was Yoshida had come on. For his debut, I think it was, but he'd only had one training session. He'd trained with him that the night before. I guess they were quite unlucky because Højbjerg went off quite early with a calf injury after his own goal. But Jovinho was really quite excellent playing as a centre forward against Southampton. And Wenger said, it's something that he'd tried on their Asian tour, got some sort of positive indications from it, and it's something that he might persist with. I mean, the obvious thing to take from that was Olivier Giroud was left on the bench in a game where people might have thought he would have got a chance to break his duck and get some confidence.
All right, producer Ben's saying that the Southampton defence parting like Jovinho's hair. Let's have a look at some numbers. Arsenal now scored 8, conceded 1. Podolski, as well as grabbing a goal, completing all 31 of his passes on Saturday. The only blemish, perhaps, in Arsenal's performance, Chesney.
Yeah, but having seen the mistake, I don't think that you can really... There'd been a lot of talk before the game about how Steve Bould had installed this new defensive solidity into Arsenal, which we hadn't seen for, well, since probably 2005, 2004. They've been a bit of a shambles for 8 years, and I think they were helped a little bit, as you were saying, by playing teams who were sitting back a bit and not having strikers. But you know, it was just one little tiny mistake that you can't really be too harsh about the defence, because he just dropped it. Isn't that little moment of concentration? Well, I don't think
I hear what you're saying. Chesney in crisis. Yeah?
Chesney's in crisis. Yeah, just on the point that you made about Trevino as well. I liked what he said. He said we turn wingers into great strikers here. Obviously, a little reference to Thierry Henry.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Excellent. Saints have lost their last. Lost their opening four. No one has ever stayed up in the Premier League having lost their first three, let alone four. Not looking good, eh?
Mm. They've had an awful run of fixtures, though, to play the two Manchester clubs, one of them away, and also
Wigan at home.
Yeah, that's the one that you'd be worried about, though. If you have those three games in between, in that run, and then you play Wigan at home, you have to get. You think you'd have to get at least a point there, and to lose 2-0 at home to Wigan, it would be a bit of concern. I think it's much easier to get up for a game against Manchester United at home than it is when you're newly promoted side. It's your second home game than it is for Wigan at home.
Hmm. Well, next up, the question is: will Giroud be in the starting lineup when they take on in the Champions League his old team Montpellier team that's fallen apart without him? They're down in 17th place. They won Ligue 1 last year. And it's a tough division to win that one. And they've now completely blown up, and they're only just outside the relegation zone. And, what's going to happen here?
I think he will play, because I think that Montpellier are a very different test. I mean, the interesting thing about Montpellier is that they don't really look to dominate possession. Even when they won the league last year, they only averaged, I think, 51% of possession. I think it's down at 49% this year.
How would you know that, Michael?
I was researching a piece the other day.
Right.
Sorry. It's not just in there.
Right.
But that means they're going to sit deep, and I think Arsenal do need someone like Giroud who will be able to hold the ball up. I mean, I wouldn't want to play Jovinho against a defence that sat very deep.
Mm. All right, then. Arsene Wenger for this one, Jacob?
No, he's banned for three games. Three-game touchline ban for his criticism of the referee after the game against Milan last season.
All right, so Steve Ball will be taking charge, will he?
They'll be even better defensively.
Wow, yeah. That's cool. All right, and Arsenal did have one or two problems on the road last year, did they not? Lost at Milan,
lost at Olympiacos.
Right.
One on the last visit to France, though.
Right, yeah. Significantly.
Yeah.
Okay, so, Gunners, I bet Montpellier will be worried. Across town from the Emirates on Saturday, the big story, QPR, Chelsea, and all the shenanigans that went on before it. Really depressing stuff. But from QPR's point of view, a big point, eh? And a big arrival between the posts, Julio Cesar.
Yeah, he looks excellent. Again, sort of, you wonder whether Inter might regret letting him go, despite how much he earned at the time.
Yeah.
But it was a hostile environment, as you'd expect. And I think Chelsea kind of got roughhoused, didn't they? That was certainly the point that Di Matteo was making. He felt that they had two stonewall penalties, whether they did or not. Well, there's the Ryan Nelson on John Terry, where Nelson kind of said that Terry should be kind of embarrassed of himself after the game for the way he went down, and there was another one, Sean White Phillips on Eden Hazard.
Oh.
But I think they were both kind of quite dubious, really.
Should Chelsea have had a penalty, Michael?
I thought the Wright Phillips on Hazard one was a clear penalty, personally.
Right. What about Fernando Torres, though? One half chance during the game and then storming off down the tunnel.
Chelsea didn't play with many attackers. They played Ramirez and Bertrand on the flanks, which was quite a defensive move. And I thought they looked better when Victor Moses came on late on and added a bit of drive. And basically they just left all the attacking to Hazard and Torres. And Hazard had a decent game, was quite involved. Torres still doesn't look to be in a position where he can create chances for himself, I think.
But this is a new twist, isn't it? Him storming off like that. We've seen him moping around, but him to openly flout the manager's authority and that. Hmm?
Yeah, no, it's interesting going into this game against Juventus because...
Yeah. Is that what it is? Do you think it's the classic kind of half-hearted league performance before a big game in Europe, this, from Chelsea? Minds elsewhere?
Well, they did rest Mata from the squad completely. He wasn't even on the bench. So there was certainly a view towards looking to Tuesday.
Torres is wingman.
Right, well, absolutely. Very interesting. Okay, so they lost their perfect record. Juve, by contrast, maintained theirs. Should we have a quick word about them? Because Raleigh Sinclair says, question for Inspector Montaljimbo. What's the Juventus situation? Will they be using three at the back? Is Pirlo suffering from the Euros? Who would you have as favourites? What with one being league champions, the other lot finishing sixth? Did you see the Juve game yesterday?
Well, and winning the Champions League.
Yeah, and winning the Champions League. On penalties.
Yeah.
Yeah, but still. Did you see the Genoa game? Who saw the Genoa game? All right. Now, that was an interesting match, wasn't it? Because they were in pieces, weren't they? They were terrible at the back, Juve, to start off with.
Yeah, I mean, the big question mark over Juventus this season is obviously last year they benefited from the fact that they weren't in European competition. They could focus on the league. This year, they're going to have to get used to that. And they rotated their squad for the game yesterday. And for the first half, it didn't look very good. They went 1-0 behind. Genoa had, I'd say, three or four chances to go 2-0 up. And
the magnificently named Ciro Immobile
got ready and scored. But yeah, I mean, Borriello hit the bar, and then there was that chance for Bertolacci to make it 2-0, and Juventus then went up the other end and scored.
And after that, it was all one way, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, they made changes at halftime. They brought on two players who you'd probably expect to be in a starting lineup, Vucinic and Asamoah. And Vucinic laid on two assists. Asamoah won a penalty and scored. So I think, I think Juventus will be quite the test for Chelsea, because they are, while they haven't played in Europe for a couple of years, well, in Champions League certainly, they're quite a tactically sophisticated team.
The interesting thing as well was that Conte, with his 10-month suspension, and Massimo Carrera, who's filling in for him, presumably with a significant amount of input from Conte, but it didn't seem to have any impact in their ability to react to a game. A lot of people were saying the big thing about Conte is substitutions, but that's proceeding smoothly. Of course, Conte will still be banned for the Stamford Bridge match.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fascinating aspect of this season for Juventus, is that Conte can still prepare the team during the week, but he's not on the touchline. So the big doubt is, well, what happens if Juventus go behind? How will they react? Well, they went behind in the Italian Super Cup to Napoli, came back to win that. They went behind on Sunday and came back to beat Genoa with some good substitutions. So I think it probably not as big a deal as many people make out.
Right. Chelsea were terrifically strong in the group stages at home last year.
They were terrifically strong throughout at home last year. Won all six of their games. And they only conceded two goals throughout that time. That was against Benfica and Napoli in the knockouts. But I'm quite interested to see how they approach it in Europe this year. You know, there's a lot of talk about how they need to be more open to satisfy Abramovich. But last year in the Champions League, they won it by being defensive and using Drogba as that focal point up front as a kind of a battering ram. That's kind of how they beat Napoli, and they basically went long against Napoli, who couldn't handle it. He's not here this time, Torres is. And you also wonder, if they're more open, whether teams like Juventus, you know, top teams like Juventus, are going to catch them out maybe on the break and if there's not enough cover. But then it is a really hard place to play, though, Stamford Bridge. They make it very, very difficult, very tight. So I think possibly a Chelsea win.
Do you now? 42 games unbeaten in the league for Juventus, so they know all about emerging undefeated.
I mean, technically they did lose their last knockout game, which is the Coppa Italia final against Napoli. But I agree with Jacob in the sense that if you look at what Juventus struggled at yesterday, it was dealing with balls over the top, Genoa's striker has been quite physical against them, which you'd think is Drogba's kind of natural game. Whereas, you know, that's not Torres, and they don't have an alternative to him. I mean, they do have this great attack with no reference points, you know, Hazard and Mata and all sorts coming at them from all different angles. But I think Wednesday night would have been a night for Didi Drog. But I still think Chelsea probably favourites.
All right, then. Just to finish off part one, then, Man United, who will be playing Galatasaray. That's quite exciting, isn't it?
Spicy,
welcome to hell. Man United have just taken on Wigan. And, big win for them there. The Butner goal, or is it Butner? That was quite exciting, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But all sorts of milestones reached, but a heady blend of the old and the new there for Man United. And are they going to do better in Europe this year, do you think, Michael?
Well, I doubt they'll get knocked out of the group stage again. I think they've got a decent draw. Galatasaray, traditionally are very strong at home, but not very good away. So I don't think they'll have that many problems this year.
All right, they won 4-0 at the weekend, Galatasaray, at Antalyaspor. Right, they've got Milan Baros, Johan Almander. Ooh, I'm seeing goals here. Emanuele Bue and Albert Riera. Look at that.
Felipe Melo as well.
Have they? Is
yeah.
he there? And Turkey's Umut Bulut, who's scored 5 in his last 4. I'm telling you what. I'm not too confident about United's chances at all there.
No, I think, curiously, if you go back to that famous game in 93-94, when it was 3-3 at Old Trafford, it was very similar to how United played against Basel last year, where they were 2-0 up quite early on. They then found themselves 3-2 down, and that they needed a late equaliser. And you got the sense last year with United, this one generation passing to another, although with Giggs and Scholes still being around, that there's that exuberance and maybe a little bit of a lack of experience in Europe again, where they're a bit too cavalier, a little bit casual, and not as controlling as they once were. So I think, as you mentioned, I mean, Galatasaray do have some decent goal scorers.
Oh, yeah.
So.
And Elmander and Baros. Yeah. All right. Jacob, another news?
Yeah, well, they played, obviously, a weakened side against Wigan. I just thought that Nick Powell's goal for the fourth goal was a really, really nice strike. And I think that anybody can...
Tell us more about Nick Powell.
He came from Crewe in the summer, and everybody, he caught the eye with his performance in the League 2 playoff final in May, when he scored a superb goal, flicked it up over his head and volleyed it in from the edge of the area. They won 1-0, that was the only goal. And Ferguson on Sunday, or today's papers, he's kind of comparing him to Paul Scholes, who scored the first goal, so, you know, nicely bookended.
Mm.
But anybody can score a long-range strike, I think. You know, you maybe that doesn't catch the eye so much, but I just like the way that he made the space, that first touch to throw the defenders off. You think that, you know, this is a guy who's maybe got something, and there's so much focus on Kagawa and Van Persie, but this, you know, he's quietly making possibly a name for himself there.
Will he get a look in Europe, do you think?
Maybe a bit too early. That's a big jump.
All right, then. Time now for us to close off part one and head towards an exciting look at Real Madrid Man City after this. There are some exciting fixtures in Europe this midweek. A few perhaps as exciting as all the raw drama at the Bernabeu as Real Madrid take on Man City. Ooh, a Man City team that's fresh from coming up short against the Crouch Owen Axis at the Britannia Stadium, 1-1 at Stoke. Quick comment on that, or...?
It was like the NBA, Mancini said.
Yeah, again and again and again he said it.
I did quite like what he said. Maybe next year we won't play this and we'll save the money on the hotels. We'll just take a point each.
It's always a 1-1 draw, isn't it?
Yeah.
So. Right. Well, there you go. It was a bit handball, wasn't it?
Crouch kind of admitted. But... Yeah, plus point for City was I think how well Javi Garcia played. He looks excellent.
All right,
He scored on his debut, a good header. He always looked a threat whenever they had a set piece, and yeah, a decent player defensively as well.
All right, well, it's a big game coming up, as I say, in Europe. Mancini's one weak spot, really, regarded his ability to compete continentally. And look, this test is against the man who has highlighted that perhaps more than any other, Jose Mourinho, who took over an Inter side that Mancini couldn't go anywhere with in Europe and took it just a season later to the Champions League title itself. The first time this that the pair have met since then. Drama. Sounds like we should dial up Sid Lowe.
Hello, James. How are you?
I'm very well. We've missed you, Sid.
That's very kind of you.
Now, what can you see happening this midweek as Real Madrid host Man City, especially after the disastrous start they've had in the Liga?
Yeah, really bad start. They've lost their first 3 competitive away games for the first time in their history. Obviously, one of those was against Barcelona in the Supercopa. Then there's been the 2 in La Liga against Getafe and now against Sevilla. Mourinho is his worst start as a coach as well. They're 8 points behind Barcelona already. Now, 8 points might not sound much. You say, well, there's loads of games to go. But bear in mind that Real Madrid only dropped 14 points in the whole of last season. It's pretty serious. And it's not just that. It's the way they're playing. Mourinho ended his press conference at the weekend with, I thought, a devastatingly powerful phrase. He said, right now, I don't have a team.
Right. Well, that's heartbreaking news, isn't it? I have no team. Few heads are concentrated, are fighting for the cause at the moment. and it's all my fault, he said.
Yeah, I think I'm really pleased, James, by the way, that you picked up on the it's all my fault, because by Mourinho saying I haven't got a team, as you can imagine, there's been a bit of a backlash to that. Particularly in Catalonia, where they're rubbing their hands in glee and they find it's absolutely hilarious. And one of the headlines on the paper, one of the Catalan papers today is like, you know, what a cheek, 450 million euros later, he says he hasn't even got a team. And a lot of people have responded to this effectively to say, look, he's blaming his players, he's saying it's all their fault, he's effectively blaming the club for not building the team. But I think the point he was making was about the mindset. And as you say, he did say, and that is my fault.
Yeah, he didn't mean it. Did he? He didn't mean it.
No, maybe he didn't. And you know, obviously he was hanging out some of his players to dry by talking about attitude and so on. But he did try and say, but it's my fault that it's like that. And it was interesting him saying that, you know, there are players who right now whose priority isn't football. And it's difficult to know exactly who he's pointing the finger at, because he said something else at the weekend which goes back to a brilliant old, very famous John Toshack quote. When Toshack was manager of Real Madrid, and Mourinho said, I made two changes at halftime, I could have made seven. And the reason why this reminded everyone of Toshack is because Toshack very famously once, when he was Real Madrid manager, said at the end of the game, you feel like next week you're going to play without 11 of them. You know, because they were all awful. By Tuesday, you think, all right, I'll leave two or three out. I'll leave seven of them out and I'll play two or three. By the Thursday, you're only going to leave out two of them. And he said, by the Saturday, you're playing with the same 11 arseholes as the week before. And that comment's become legendary in Spain. And there was a hint of that about what Mourinho was saying at the weekend.
All right, so Sid, whose fault is it? Is it Luka Modric in the kind of Faustino Asprilla role?
No, definitely not. And Modric is one of the players who's actually played better in the last couple of games. He came on and made a difference for about 5 or 10 minutes, then drifted out of the game. But he hit the post with one really good effort. And I think he gives Real Madrid something that they maybe didn't have. I think it's interesting as well that Mourinho has focused all of his criticism so far this season on the mindset of the players. And I must confess, I'm not completely convinced by that argument, because when I see Real Madrid play now, I see some of the faults they had last year, despite that incredible season. Some of the faults they had the year before, despite having a pretty good season the year before, even though they didn't win the league. And I don't think it's for lack of effort. I don't think it's for lack of aggression. I don't think it's necessarily for lack of commitment, although they've been really bad at key moments in set plays. I think it's actually for lack of ideas, lack of imagination and creativity at times, which is bizarre considering the players they've got. So I think Mourinho focusing it all on the mental state of his players, I think it's a very very slight red herring. Yes, it's true that some of the sharpness isn't there, but I think there's more to it than that. I think there's a lack of, to use the Spanish phrase, there's a lack of football.
All right. Well, what's going to happen then? Will we have high football when Man City arrive?
I don't know the answer to that, because you know, Madrid have been in this kind of supposedly dire state before in the build-up to the second leg of the Supercopa, and they've been really pretty destroyed by Barcelona in the first leg and were very, very lucky to get away with a 3-2, and they went into second leg, and Mourinho talked then about the mindset and said that what he was really worried about was his players' reactions, and they reacted brilliantly, and they were exceptional, at least for about half an hour, maybe 45 minutes in that game against Barcelona. So I imagine there'll be some sort of response. Bear in mind that the sheer quality of players that Madrid have got means that even if other things aren't quite working, they should be able to get a result against Man City. The other thing in all of this, and you know, maybe it's not really my place to say this considering I'm here to talk to you about Spanish football, is Roberto Mancini just doesn't convince me.
No, well, I'm sorry to hear that. Right, 8 points behind it. Well, go on, tell us, what is it? What is it that doesn't convince you about Mancho?
Well, I mean, perhaps the two players he said wouldn't play for City again, rescuing the league title for him is one place to start.
Anyway, so now, moving on to the Europa League. How about Sunderland, Liverpool? Liverpool, no wins in four, not since. Well, estimates vary. I went with 104 years, then I heard 109, and now I'm reading it's not since 1911, but over 100 years, over a century since they had this bad a start. How bad was it at the Stadium of Light?
It was kind of what you would expect from this fixture, in the sense that Liverpool dominated possession, but they just couldn't turn it into clear-cut chances, and when they did have chances, they couldn't turn it into goals. So it was kind of more of the same, really.
Oh, all right.
Sterling was bright again. I think he set up Suarez's goal with a decent little step-over move.
Titus Bramble set up Suarez's goal.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
And next up, Liverpool will try and improve their fortunes, try and get a first win, apart from that Hearts game in the preliminary. They're at Young Boys of Bern, who, of course, gave Spurs a scare, didn't they, on their plastic pitch. couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very different team, though. Young Boys have lost quite a lot of players.
So have they got new Young Boys in?
They have, yeah. Even younger boys, yeah.
Oh, okay. They've sold, of course, their Zambian striker, Muyaka, to Southampton.
Is it Mayuka, I think, isn't it?
Might be. All right. They still have Michael Frey, or Fry, as you prefer, and other players as well. But, what do you think? Liverpool away. They need a win, don't they? Need a win.
It's a tough atmosphere, actually, at Young Boys. I mean, you don't really associate Swiss football with kind of red-hot atmospheres, but...
Yeah. Paul Doyle does. Paul Doyle's very big on Swiss football. And, okay, so it's a tough away
fixture.
What was
that laugh?
I don't know. They're having some joke about hoodies.
Can you imagine a sort of tough atmosphere being...
Young Boys. There's nothing scarier than youth. Yeah, and Swiss youth. Particularly. All right, well, I'll move on from that then, shall I? You want to talk about, Gazza-related stuff and Tottenham-Lazio, but Fulham-West Brom. First off, Fulham-West Brom, Burb. How could we have doubted it? How could we have doubted it?
Who doubted it?
But lots of people did. They went, I'm not sure if this is going to work. They've lost Dembele, they've lost Dempsey. And Berbatov, is he bothered? Well, he is.
Well, I saw Fulham play a couple of weeks ago at Upton Park, and they were really flimsy. You could tell they'd been. It was just a huge setback to lose Dembele and Dempsey in that week. But when Berbatov came on at half time, there was just a noticeable shift that everyone in the crowd at West Ham suddenly thought, "Oh, you know, we're 3-0 up." But he does look like a class act, and he didn't do a lot. But it was just these little moments where he was bringing the ball down and sort of shrugging off defenders, sending them off in the distance, and I looked at that and thought, when he plays, they're going to be a much better side. And he's, you know, two goals on the full debut against a good West Brom side.
Yeah, although West Brom side weakened by Peter Adam Wiggins' moment of madness.
Yeah, that's stupid, yeah.
Mm. All right, when I'm happy, things happen, said the Burb. Gotta love him.
Good imagine.
Yep. Oh, and Aston Villa, let's mention them as well. That's their first win in 14. Smiles back on the faces of Villa Park. James Horncastle.
Yeah, I saw the highlights. They look quite sparkling. The Loughton goal had a wicked curl on it. There's lots of promise there. I mean, Brad Guzan was stepping in for Shea Given. I thought he had a good save from Ashley Williams. Oddly for Swansea, who I think have profited from other people's mistakes so far, they made a few mistakes against Villa for Williams headed back to allow Benteke in, who promptly scored. Benteke, I think... Paul Lambert said afterwards, it's unplayable at times. It seems to be how everyone is describing certain players these days. Yep. But
he's got a great record against Swansea as well. Seems to be the one manager who knows absolutely how to take them on. He's five wins in six games, Paul Lambert against Swansea, yeah.
I did like how dour he was afterwards. He said he's still 3,000 miles away from where he wants Villa to be. I don't know what's 3,000 miles away from Birmingham.
Quite a lot of places, yeah. Right, producer Ben's got a compass out and an atlas, and he'll be getting back to us. Talking about similarly named forward partners, Darius, because we were, intriguingly, Bent and Bentaki, of course, playing there for Aston Villa. Here's Maxi Kiosko, who says, talking about similarly named forward partners, Darren Bent and Marcus Bent, of course, started a number of games together up front for Ipswich between 2001 and 2004. Didn't they also play together at Charlton? Or am I going bonkers?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. One went on to play for 3 Premier League clubs and 13 times for England. The other has just been released by Indonesian side Mitra Kukar. Right. Much more to come as we tackle the Spurs-Lazio game and more. Right. This just in on the 3,000 miles from Birmingham angle. The Birmingham Mail earlier this year ran a story about a homing pigeon called Percy, who took a 3,000-mile wrong turn and ended up in Canada. So that's exactly where Paul Lambert's team
wants to be.
I see. Yeah, that's where he wants them to be. Yeah. It could work.
They're coming back, the pigeon, I guess.
Yeah. Anyway, I didn't know you could... Is that only 3,000 miles between Birmingham and... I suppose that makes sense. Just, you know, maybe over the Arctic or something. Right. Geography, eh? Fantastic. Top breaking news, Jacob. Top football story today.
Oh, yeah, Prince William lost a penalty shootout to a 13-year-old, like a true Englishman.
Right, where was this?
This was on the Solomon Islands.
Right.
He's doing something for charity or something.
Right.
He was challenged to a shootout by a 13-year-old keeper, and he took 3 penalties, missed 2, scored 1.
Mm.
Keeper saved them both, though.
Right. Yeah. He's a Villa fan, of course.
Yeah, he was telling all the kids they should support Aston Villa, and maybe they should now.
Maybe they should. Yeah. Sounds like he's not very good up front. Unlike his wife, he said, labouring that one and really managing to cram it in, but then here you go. Super. Right. Let's move on. Dante meets Bosch, who says, on a completely different topic, I think it's a bit harsh to say Bentley was another of Redknapp's costly signings that he forgot about, because Bentley was brought in the Ramos era. And also, Redknapp didn't make many expensive signings at Spurs. Yeah, only two players cost more than $10 million, apparently. There you go. Now,
he's a good wheeler dealer, Redknapp.
He's not. He's not an effing wheeler dealer.
Would you say that?
And he doesn't
face?
Baffle his players, unlike some managers.
Yeah.
Because he had a bit of a go at Villas-Boas this weekend. And Villas-Boas took those words and ran them right back down his throat with an extraordinary 3-1 win at the Medeski Stadium. It was a big game on Sunday afternoon. Is this the first proper look at Villas-Boas' side? Does the season start here, Jacob?
Yeah, I was looking just at the team sheet they had laid out in the paper this morning, and just thought that actually looks like a half decent side with, especially midfield with Sandro, who just looked fitter than he has been for a while, and Dembele coming in for his first start. He made that impact against Norwich in the last game, but he came on as a sub, and then Sigurdsson as well, who played a lovely little pass for that first goal through to Lennon to set up Defoe. And you think that they have lost Modric, but those three together, that's quite a nifty side there. And I'm still not sure too much about playing Defoe as that lone striker.
Really? Because
I know he got two goals yesterday, but I just don't think that he's quite big enough or mobile enough.
Managers never do, but there you are. Villas-Boas is putting his faith in Jermaine.
Yeah,
and he's got a friend in Defoe. They must have said that on Match of the Day. No, probably not.
No.
Did they not? No. Good Lord. But anyway, yeah, he's been rewarded, isn't he, for his persistence with... Yeah?
Yeah, because I think one of the things that was remarkable before the game was you saw on the bench, Spurs bench, was Adebayor and Dempsey.
Hmm?
And I saw some people criticising him for not lining up with the team. But as Jacob said, you look at the players he managed to shoehorn into that team.
Hmm?
You know, Dembele, Sandro, Bale and Lennon all together. It is quite an exciting thing. And what was impressive about Spurs yesterday was kind of what they did off the ball. You always saw these players just bombing forward to take Reading players away from one of their teammates. It happened. Well, if you look at the first goal that Defoe scored, it was a case of Lennon making a run between the fullback and centre back to be on for this Sigurdsson pass, and then also for Defoe's third goal, you saw Bale just bombing out of nowhere to take another man away to allow Defoe to carry on his run and have space to score.
Nice. What about the kits?
San Antonio Spurs. They're the NBA team that Mancini was talking about.
Oh, right. Is that San Antonio colours they were wearing? Because people made reference to the Oakland Raiders.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Clive Allen, Marcus Allen.
Right. Yep, yeah, there you go. Interesting. What about their chances at home to a Lazio team on a 5-game winning streak in all competitions? A Lazio team that maintained its role near the top or level with Juventus in Serie A with a brilliant 3-1 win away at Chievo yesterday.
Yeah, they look fantastic, particularly Hernandez, who scored a couple of fantastic goals. With this fixture, I wonder how seriously Lazio will take it, because over the last few years, Italian clubs haven't really put that much effort into the Europa League, I should say. Whereas Villas-Boas obviously made his name by winning the Europa League, and I think we'll want to do the same again with Tottenham. So I'd favour Tottenham for that reason.
Right, interesting. I'm not sure. Petkovic, Vladimir Petkovic, the manager who's got them all excited in the capital there, says they are extra hungry ahead of this game. And the team are flying. You've got to think they want to capitalise on that momentum. Hernandez, you say, looked brilliant. His best game, a lot of people are saying, for Lazio so far. Two goals. The second one, very similar, curiously, to Defoe's second at Reading. Burning past the fullback and then putting it in from a difficult angle. Sorry, dude.
Yeah.
And of course, you've got Closer as well. Sorry, I just have to say, who Spurs wanted to get, I believe. He turned down a move to Spurs, and now he could come back and haunt them.
And Hernandez as well, apparently. Did he also turn down a move to Spurs? Yeah.
Wow.
Which you look at the kind of players, he is sort of similar to a Modric or a Moutinho, if you like. But, I mean, one of the things that people have said about Petkovic's Lazio is that Lazio made very few changes to the team in the summer. They kept the same 11. But the sort of difference is that Petkovic's predecessor, Eddie Reha, would always substitute Hernandez, always leave him on the bench or whatnot. And he seems to have been given a lot more playing time, but also a lot of freer role for Lazio. They've got a really good midfield, you know, in terms of Ledesma, Mauri, Candreva, and Hernandez, and they really pack all those. They play 4-5-1. But as you were saying, you know, they with Closer, I mean, he's a world class striker. He only needs one chance. Playing away from home, I know it's a group stage game, but I'd actually be quite confident. I know Italian teams typically don't take the Europa League seriously, but after the kind of humiliation that they've suffered year on year out, I think it's kind of become very apparent to them that they need to improve if they are to improve their coefficient points. Mm.
And I think they do need a good Europa League run as a country, because they've obviously only got two Champions League sides. Juventus have been given quite a difficult draw. And Milan, personally, I think they're quite a poor side this year, and I wouldn't be surprised to see them.
Well, you're not wrong there. Yeah. All right, so Spurs, Lazio, and interesting. It's going to be a tense one, that, on Thursday. Just moving on to the weekend's results, you mentioned Milan being poor. They've lost their first two home games for the first time since 1930. And, of course, the word is now that Massimiliano Allegri could be on his way. Anderlecht could be a decisive match?
Not for now. I mean, I agree with Michael that Milan are desperately, well, poor, considering the expectations that usually surrounds them. I mean, Anderlecht, who they'll play in midweek, you know, they're also having a pussy. They've drawn three games in the Belgian league, so no. You might expect them to still win that. But the thing that Allegri just can't, he calls it a psychological block that Milan have got, that they're using the Ibrahimovic and Thiago Silva sales as an excuse for them not to do well, when he wanted them instead to think everyone's writing you off, use that as motivation to have a decent season.
Right. Oh, that sounds much better, yeah. Okay, you might say that it sounds a bit early for a manager to be beginning the chop in Serie A, but not at all, because of course Palermo have already opened the fun and games. We had 19 changes last year. We've already had one this year. Palermo firing Giuseppe Sannino after their 1-1 draw against Cagliari. In his place, they've brought in Giampiero Gasperini, who was fired at almost exactly the same point of last season by Inter. It is, I believe, the 44th dismissal of Zamperini's time as club owner. That might include his time at Venezia, where he was pretty trigger-happy as well. Fantastic stuff. Anyway, in other news, Milan closed their season ticket campaign with just 23,000 season ticket holders. That's the worst. Presumably that includes some who returned their season tickets after Ibrahimovic was sold. Lazio's great start to the season has been improved by the fact that Roma stuffed things up royally at the weekend. Roma came into this weekend fresh on that terrific performance away to Inter, where everybody hailed Zeman's tactical masterpiece, etc. And this weekend was a little bit of a refresher course in what Zeman football actually means.
Yeah, I mean, Roma were 2-0 up and cruising in the first half. Totti was sensational. And yet they seemed to run out of gas. Zeman threw on more attackers as the game went on, and Roma conceded two in a minute to Gilardino and Diamanti, and then Gilardino scored another one to make it 3-2. So yeah, no, it was typical Zemanlandia. I mean, in the Curva Sud beforehand, there was a big banner which had Zeman depicted as a saint with 4-3-3 as his cardinal kind of
and a lovely slogan above it.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter how much you run, it's why you run and where you run. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. But typical sinning Zeman yesterday.
Right,
but interesting, because the Inter game with Roma, Inter's Curva held up a banner praising Zeman, honour to Zeman, father of clean footballer. And then when Lazio played Chievo yesterday, Chievo's Curva held up a banner praising Zeman.
Did they?
And Lazio seemed to have this inferiority complex. Latito came out yesterday saying, you know, we are the first team, we're the top team in the capital right now.
Right.
And they've appropriated the Colosseum as their symbol.
Well, good luck to them. They are very much the top team in the capital right now. They're on maximum points with Juve, 3-3. And Napoli up there as well. Napoli had a big 3-1 victory against Parma, with the first goal for Napoli by the young man they're getting very hot under the collar about down there in southern Italy, Insigne. Is he all that?
Yeah, I think he is. He was a member of Zeman's team Pescara last year,
right?
And he scored, I think, 18 goals and got into double figures with assists as well. He's Napoli born and bred, and he's one of the reasons why I think De Laurentiis was open to letting Lavezzi go to Paris Saint-Germain this year, because he proved himself to be that good. And what's interesting is Naples is always a very hard city to grow up in and not let things go to your head. Because Insigne, he's had two good apprenticeships under Zeman at Foggia and Pescara, and Del Piero is his sort of role model. He wants to be a Neapolitan Del Piero, which, I mean, if you can be as level-headed off the pitch as Del Piero, that stands Napoli in good stead.
All right, speaking of level-headed, by the way, and we could mention Del Piero going to Australia, but speaking of level-headed, Marek Hamšík, his new haircut.
I didn't see that.
Did you not? Basically, previously he had that bizarre kind of... Was it Jedward-esque? Maybe a little bit more Kid and Play. I'm not sure. Now he's gone for basically a Roman centurion plume without the haircut. So you've basically got like a privet hedge following the ridge of his cranium. It looks $1 million. Didn't like it before. Now I'm a big fan. In other haircut news, Rodrigo Palacio still has his Padawan rat tail. So there you go. And Inter, Palacio's side... are playing against Rubin Kazan this week. The bad news is they're going to be playing at home at the San Siro. Why is that bad news? Well, because they have a perfect record away from home in all competitions this year. They've won all their games, and I think they haven't conceded a single goal away from home. Inter, at home, they cannot win. Bizarrely, the same is true of Milan. Can't win at home. Got a victory away at Pescara, although it was at Pescara. And it's all, say the Italians now, about the new pitch they laid in the summer.
Yeah, which is strange, because you would have thought that the terrible pitch we've seen at San Siro pretty much since Italia 90, where they put the roof on top of it, has made conditions poor for Milan to play on, and we've seen other clubs in Italy, smaller clubs like Cesena and Novara, bring in these third generation, fourth generation plastic pitches, and they've had, well, both have gone down.
In their home game against Arsenal last season, the bad pitch actually helped them, because it was particularly bad down the flanks. Milan are really weak down the flanks, play very narrow, the fullbacks aren't very good, and Arsenal were really afraid to attack down there. So maybe their bad pitch helped them last year.
Well, I think it's a very fair point. Dig a few defensive ramparts and they could be they could be back in business. Interesting. Football Weekly always first with the tactical innovations. That's it for today's show. We'll be back on Thursday after the Champions League excitement. Many thanks then to producer Ben, Jacob Steinberg.
Thanks.
Bye. James Horncastle.
Thank you.
And Michael Cox.
Thank you. Goodbye.
And goodbye to you, listener, too. See you on Thursday.